My name is Tom Evans, and I'm a geologist with the Wisconsin Geological Survey. I live in Madison, Wisconsin. And I, as I say often enough anymore, I don't do any honest geology work. It seems like I do most of my work involving the issues of mining regulation and issues of that nature. I have, for the last 10 years, been in Wisconsin, and most of that time has been spent dealing with the development of the regulation of metallic mining in the state of Wisconsin and issues related to that. How do we regulate mineral development and do it in a way that is fair to mining companies, fair to the publics in the state of Wisconsin? Interested a lot in the process of how we arrive at decisions. But it's not only been mineral resources. I have served for the last couple of years as a chairman of the Technical Advisory Council, a long name, to the Radioactive Waste Review Board in the state of Wisconsin, because Wisconsin was so extensively interested and still is extensively interested in the radioactive waste disposal issue, and an issue which hits close to home here, and obviously in the state of Washington, but also hit very close to home to us in Wisconsin. And so it is, in a sense, a technical issue which has non-technical dimensions. And I've been interested for some time in how one makes those kinds of decisions. So I've been interested in process, how we go about doing that. I'm not a, as you will find out very quickly, I'm not a theologian. I don't have that kind of grounding in theology. I'm more or less a practitioner, just hopefully as many as you are. I'm just a Christian trying to figure out how one goes about these things fairly and in an equitable manner. But let me start out with some definitions, so we have some common ground. And I know I'm not supposed to do this, but you can interrupt me at any time. They always say, "Well, you can always say that, but nobody will do it." But feel free to interrupt me. That's perfectly okay. Hopefully, I won't lose my place. But it doesn't matter if I do, because then we'll go off in a direction that you're interested in going, and that's fine. But let me talk first about what I mean about a technical decision. Basically, I'm talking about a decision that is made by government, which essentially is dealing with a technical or scientific or engineering issue. As a geologist, I'm aware that there are certain issues which I know what the answer is, right? Because I know the facts. Right. Now, I'm putting "no" in quotes, because I understand that there's a certain spread to our understanding of knowledge, and that we could have scientists debating a particular issue. I understand that. But basically, there are certain issues which there are facts, and there are facts. I mean, that's just the way it is, as opposed to issues in which there are a bunch of feelings about how things should be. So what I'm focusing on are these areas in which there are a certain body of knowledge, certain body of scientific fact, which gets caught up in the development of public policy related to those facts. And an example I'll use over and over again may be something like groundwater protection. How do we protect groundwater? Well, there's a certain body of knowledge about groundwater, its movement, how it moves, where it occurs, how do we affect it, what qualities of groundwater are there which relate to our use of groundwater. And in the state of Wisconsin, that's been a very hot issue. And so we might use that as an example a couple times to show how we have make decisions about groundwater. Groundwater is, for me, a pretty much a technical issue, but it is, in terms of the development of policy, something which we must deal with in a non-technical world. How do we deal with it? There are many other kinds of issues besides groundwater. One could talk about siting a waste disposal site. As a scientist, I believe that I can, given a certain geography, find the best place to site a waste disposal site. I could make a technical decision, but oftentimes that technical decision has to be made in a non-technical world. There are other ramifications about that decision which are considered to be important by people who are affected by it. The siting of a nuclear waste, rather a siting of a nuclear power plant is another example. The siting of a nuclear waste facility, in which there are many technical dimensions of the siting of that facility, but the resolution of that siting issue was done in a very non-technical manner. And if you want to, we can get into a discussion of how that took place. But my concern is, how does one go about doing that? What is the process that is fair? Now let me distinguish something. Something like Star Wars or the Strategic Defense Initiative, I do not consider to be a technical issue. There are so many pseudo-technical aspects about something like Star Wars that just go well beyond my ability to understand them. You will not get the scientific community in any way to agree on what is a scientific basis for a strategic defense initiative, and whether you support SDI or oppose SDI is irrelevant in terms of a technical issue, because I just think there is no technical consensus on that issue. But many of the other things, there is a technical consensus or a technical understanding that exists. And those are the kinds of issues I want to get into. What do I mean by, say, a non-technical world? Obviously, scientists live in the world, but what I mean by this is the development of policy for society in general in dealing with this particular topic. I'm not talking about a decision where a geologist might pick up a rock and another geologist pick up the same rock and we would disagree on those. I'm not talking about that world of scientific disagreement. I'm talking about the world in which people have to take technical understandings and put them into some kind of a public policy framework. And maybe this will become more clear as we go along, or as we go. Are we on the same wavelengths or at all? I mean, I'm talking about how we take what is essentially an issue which scientists can agree upon in terms of its dimensions and apply that somehow in the development of policy. And it is how we translate a technical position into a policy position that interests me.
What? How the scientists do it?
I'm interested in how it's done in a non-technical world, and how science inputs into that, but how government, in particular, takes that information and how they go about making policy with it. I'm interested in the process in which that is accomplished, because I think it behooves us to understand those processes. And I'm going to talk about what I call styles of policy development with respect to technical issues. And some of this is kind of basic civics, and some of this gets into some of the more subtle aspects of civics, if you will. Let me start with the first basic style. And this is one that's going to be, I'm sure, familiar to all of you. And that is a legislative style. And by that I mean, this is the typical means by which for an issue, let's say it's the development of groundwater protection policy. This is the typical way in which government operates. And by this I mean an issue comes to the forefront in some way, and a bill is proposed to a legislator or a group of legislators. A bill is drafted, and that bill goes through a series of committees, and there is discussion about the bill and the contents of the bill, and there are modifications made to the bill and compromises made, and finally it's reported out onto the floor either of Congress at the federal level or a state legislature at the state level, and it is debated, and finally it is either passed or defeated. The very standard process by which we try to take ideas or issues and put them into some kind of a policy. Now obviously I'm using policy here as this kind of a big assemblage of laws and regulations and codes of behavior that we codify into our legal framework in this country. So the first style of decision making is a fairly straightforward legislative style. Somebody has an issue and they propose a resolution to the issue, and they get a legislator interested in it, and that person or group of persons will then carry that forward through the process. And what I want to think about are, what are the good aspects of that process and what are the negative aspects of that process? Can we think of any good aspects of the process? What's good about that style of developing policy in a technical arena? Any ideas?
You can put an enforcement provision into technical, for example, on groundwater.
Mm-hmm.
Keep the guy dumping on the road roadside.
Okay, you can cover a variety of issues in that particular topic through that one mechanism. Enforcement is one example. Any other thoughts of what might be good about this particular process?
It's orderly, anti-chaotic. People know what to expect, know how to deal with it.
It's familiar.
Yeah.
Traditional. We understand, in a sense, that arena. Orderly and chaotic. It's a nice juxtaposition of words for the legislative process. We've seen some real bizarre things happen in the legislature, as for sure. But there is a certain order to it. There is a process we understand. Any other thoughts on what's good about that particular process?
Well, it also requires some consensus as opposed to a dictated.
I'm sorry, I'm not hearing.
It requires a consensus as opposed to a dictated solution.
Okay. Yes, there is a certain degree of consensus that must take place. Obviously, a bill to be passed or defeated requires a majority, usually. And in either passage or defeat, a position has been taken, and a certain amount of consensus takes place. The only reason I'm hesitating over the word consensus is I'm going to come use that as another style, and I'm going to differentiate between a consensus of 51% versus a consensus style of development of policy. Democracy in action, right? And this is what we're talking about. This is how our system works. So we're familiar with it. It's traditional. Any other thing about it?
It brings the problems to the front.
It does bring the problems to the front. Puts our legislators, those who we elect, they become aware of those problems. It is also an accountable process. Those who make these decisions are accountable in some form or another to us for the decisions that they make. What might be some of the bad points about this style of policy development? What might be a negative feature about it?
Small groups can take advantage of it sometimes.
Boy, absolutely correct. It is vulnerable to a small but organized, vocal, savvy approach how to work the system, which may not be a majority view, it may be a minority view. Any other thoughts on what might be kind of a negative about this particular process?
Could be attached to another bill, that is.
I'm sorry, what
could be attached to another bill that would be desirable.
Yeah, that's good. That's a good point. There's a trick. There are tricks to the trade of getting certain viewpoints into law, and that's to attach something that may not be popular into something that is popular, and boy, that's done all the time. In our state, we just recently moved from passing a budget every 2 years to passing a budget every year. And that budget bill, because you got to have money, you got to have a budget bill, that budget bill gets bigger and bigger and bigger, even though it's only for 1 year, because people begin to put in their own particular ideas. And so policy gets made in a way which is almost unintentional, in the sense that other people don't know about it. It's hidden in another bill. It doesn't, may not get the full debate that it may deserve. How about the qualifications of the people dealing with a technical issue? Boy, it's something that just drives me nuts. When we sit as a scientist now, and I'm, this is a lot of this is just personal reflection now, of course, but as a scientist, it drives me nuts to see some of these legislators dealing with an issue like groundwater protection. I mean, come on, what do they know about groundwater, right? They know nothing about it. And I know all this stuff about groundwater, and they know nothing about it. What right do they have to make policy with respect to that particular issue?
Actually, in that context, I have a question. Is there anyone in either senator or representative of our country that is a scientist now?
Oh, sure. And the most direct source I can think of, and I'm not sure if he's still a senator, is Senator Harrison Schmidt of New Mexico. Former astronaut, well-schooled in physics, geology. Certainly there are scientific people in the legislative arena, but they are in a vast, vast minority. Most of these people are lawyers. No offense, Vern.
Watch it.
But, you know, it's the old thing, some of my best friends are lawyers, but most of these people are not trained in technical issues. They're trained in legal issues, or in some cases simply political issues, or political savvy, you know, how to get elected and keep the constituents happy by representing their particular viewpoints, which is certainly a legitimate background. I think basically those are some of the issues that come to mind when I think about that. And there's one other thing that I want to mention about legislative, and that's, where do legislators get their information? Given that they're not technical people, where do they get their information about an issue?
Lobbyists.
Do lobbyists have an axe to grind, perhaps?
Some of them do.
Some do. Some do. If you talk to a lobbyist, and I know lobbyists, I know several lobbyists. There's a fellow in our church who's a lobbyist for the Canners and Growers Association or something like this. And he is providing, his job is to provide information to our state legislature about issues that are fundamental to those people who grow vegetables and canned vegetables, Del Monte kinds of beans and this kind of thing. that's his job. Now, the issue is whether or not all that information is always objective. And assuming that it's not always objective, I mean, that's perfectly okay to give unobjective information, as long as there's a whole raft of other information that's coming in, so that one sort of legislator can kind of pick and choose. But the source of information, I think, is sometimes a question as to whether or not they're getting a full range of ideas. Go on to another one. Now, we can quibble over these if you'd like, in terms of whether or not you want to think these are any good, these definitions or these styles. I'm going to call this an agency style, and I really don't have a good word for this one. In state government and federal government, We obviously have Congress and legislators, but we also have agencies, which are essentially arms or extensions, if you will, of the executive branch of government. And Congress can pass laws, but it is the agencies which propose and work through and pass eventually and adopt regulations. And you need to understand that laws are one thing and administrative rules or regulations are quite another thing. Okay? We can adopt a law which says, we can adopt a law which says that groundwater cannot be contaminated and cannot be allowed to be polluted beyond the drinking water standards, something of that nature. Okay? Well, that's all well and good. That's policy and a technical issue. But what does that mean in terms of actual enforcement? Okay. Well, you go to an agency that has to adopt rules to put that law into effect. And that agency goes through a process of adopting rules. And it may say that in order to achieve this goal of not polluting the groundwater beyond, say, drinking water standards, the rules are that you cannot change the ambient quality of groundwater. Okay? No action, no construction of a plant or creation of a waste disposal pit or whatever can be allowed to have an impact on groundwater. So let's say off the site of the disposal site. Or, as in our state, a mine cannot change groundwater more than 1,200 feet beyond the boundaries of the site, mine site. 1,200 feet, I mean, you know, where did these come up with? But rules, they had to come up with some kind of rule. You got to have some place to measure it by, so they came up with 1,200 feet. If you're interested in a practice which may affect groundwater quality, you better know what that agency is proposing in terms of putting this law into effect, because these rules will have the effect of law. They're not law. The legislators never came up with a 1,200 foot distance from a mine site. You cannot change groundwater. They would never come up with that. They would be quibbling from now until hell freezes over about whether it should be 900 feet or 1,000 feet or 1,200 or 1,400. Whose ox is gored by 1,200 feet versus 1,000 feet? No, they said no. That's beyond us. Let the agency do that. Well, agencies have a particular way of operating. I just want to by this little digression emphasize that this is a very important part of policy development. But agencies can also be used to deal with technical issues in a more fundamental way, besides just rule development. They can also be used to propose ideas for policy development. And let's think about what might be some of the good points about having an agency actively involved in dealing with a technical issue in terms of developing policy about it.
We should have a question first before we
sure.
begin. That is, how, one thing I don't know is how the agencies are actually formed. Who are the people on the agencies?
Okay.
Are they technical or?
Okay.
What?
They're going to be technical and non-technical, both. Agencies generally are agents of the executive branch of government, and their leaders are generally appointed by the executive branch. Or the other style that's very common is that through some process, the executive branch appoints a board, maybe a board of citizens, which the agency is then underneath that board. It kind of removes it one level from, say, instead of having the governor appoint every head of every agency, the governor may appoint members of a board, and then that board establishes the policy for the agency. I hope I'm not being too confusing about that. In Wisconsin, that's very, very important to us because some of our agency heads are directly responsible to the governor, and some of our agency heads are responsible to a board. And if you want to get rid of an agency head who's responsible to a board, it just takes longer because you can't change the board overnight. These boards always have staggered terms, you know, and so the governor comes in and says, boy, I'm going to do away with that lousy policy that agency's been following for years. I'm going to change the board. Well, in May, the board member's terms comes up and he's got one board member he can appoint. You know, well, you can't, it takes time. So some agencies are kind of insulated from the governor, but ultimately, agencies tend to be responsive to the executive branch of government. Who are in agencies? And this gets at what I think are some of the good points about agencies. Generally, these tend to be technical people. They tend to have a certain degree of competence. They tend to have been at this game for a period of time. In other words, they tend to have been working in the arena of this particular technical issue. Let's just use groundwater, for example. They tend to have been working in the groundwater arena for a period of time. They have education along those lines and a period of time in which they have actually dealt with those issues at a sort of a nitty-gritty kind of level, a kind of a base level. So I think that's one of the strong points about agencies as a place where policy might begin to be formulated. Okay, but to me, that's one of the strong points. Well, what's a weak point about that? Who effectuates policy? Who puts policy into place? Not agencies. Ultimately, an agency can't put policy into place. It can propose it, but ultimately, it's got to come back to the legislature. Now, there is a certain way in which agencies can in place that can affect policy. There's nothing a legislator hates to do more, from my experience, than to revisit an issue that has been very emotional and very hard charged. They don't like to go back and redo it. Although in our state we have passed a tax structure for metallic mining, a different tax structure three times in the last 15 years. Sometimes they have a perverse interest in those kind of things. But basically, a legislator, in my experience, doesn't like to keep going back to an issue, particularly if it's been divisive. He likes to settle it. He or she likes to settle it. Excuse my exclusive language. The legislator likes to settle an issue and get on with something else. But so basically, they'll pass a law, and then an agency will adopt or propose rules. And it's pretty rare, in my experience, that a legislature will go back into those rules. Now there is a process. Legislative body will generally review the rules, but it's pretty rare that they get into them in any kind of a detailed way. So an agency, in effect, adopts policy through the rulemaking process. Now what's bad about that? How accountable is that agency? Oh yeah, for sure, they're accountable in one sense to the executive branch of government, right? But when you begin to put more and more people there, you begin to put layers of protection, and the accountability becomes fuzzier and fuzzier all the time. How about public involvement in the development of agency rules? Usually there is a way of getting at that. But usually it's after the rules have been proposed, not in the development of a rule proposal. Now, there are exceptions to all of this, and I want to just indicate that, but I want to speak somewhat in generalities for a while. Another good thing about agencies dealing with technical issues is that they generally have resources available to them to deal with the issue. They have people, and they have money in terms of their budgets, and they can bring those resources to bear on a particular issue. Let me go to a third style.
Tom, sure. Before you leave that,
okay.
I think it's worth mentioning at this point that also in a world in which you are always allocating scarce resources, that someone has to say no. A legislative body, for example, in Washington, may be faced with 3,000 or 3,500 proposals for action in a given session, and mercifully, they do not act more than a few hundred.
Right.
That's probably too many. An agency left to its own discretion might very well consume far more of the resources available collectively than that particular problem merits
mm-hmm.
when viewed against other things, and the legislative body must make those policy determinations.
Good point. If I can, let me be sure I am understanding. We could have an agency that is so consumed with the development of groundwater regulations
that
takes up resources which really need to be dealt with monitoring surface water standards or monitoring wildlife management programs, which all may be housed in the same agency as they are in my state of Wisconsin. And we may, by focusing on one issue, take resources away. And it is that plurality of issues and then the jockeying for position for resources among those issues that kind of is another way of keeping a perspective.
Since by definition they are experts in that area only, they might totally fail to appreciate the need to build public housing mm-hmm. or something else.
That's right.
And quite understandably.
Good point. Good point. Another style which is very popular these days, and I can say some of these things about this style because I'm not back in Wisconsin now. But this is the style called consensus. Now, let me try to define what I mean by consensus. Okay, because consensus sounds very good on the surface. I mean, everybody agrees that we should come to some kind of a consensus about certain issues. But basically what the consensus style of policy development with respect to a technical issue has been in my experience is that what you try to do is bring the major actors together around the table. And those actors, or another term might be stakeholders, those people who have a stake in the results of a particular issue, you bring them together and have them sit down essentially around a table and present their viewpoints and their ideas, their so-called bottom lines, what they have to get out of this particular resolution of this issue. You can use consensus for non-technical issues too. I don't want to imply this is only for, obviously, for technical, but it's one that's been used extensively in my state to deal with a technical issue like groundwater protection. So basically, what you do is, and I'll just use the symbol of a table, you bring industry around that table, you bring townspeople around that table, just the general public, you bring regulators around that table. You bring all of the interests, to say Native Americans,
who might be affected by the policy, the Canning and Growers Association, or whatever might be some of the publics that are affected by whatever resolution is going to come out. And the idea is, by bringing everybody who has a stake in the issue together, that, and everybody says, look, this is what my concern is, this is what I know about this, this is what I have to get out of this legislation. And if there is an agreement around that table that something has to happen, some resolution of this problem must take place. For example, if we agree that we have to have controls, regulations that deal with the protection of our groundwater, we agree to that we need to do that, well then we better have everybody who has a stake in that issue better be there, okay? In other words, those industries which may contaminate by their normal practices groundwater better be there to be sure that if protective regulations are adopted, that they can somehow live with them, or that they are technically feasible regulations from their perspective. If you're a townsperson and you want to be sure, or say an environmental group, this would be better for groundwater, but say an environmental group, like say a Sierra Club group, or in our state, Citizens for a Better Environment, or whatever your environmental label might be, you better be there around that table to be sure that the toughest regulations as you can possibly get into law or into effect are put there. So everybody who has a stake in that needs to be at that table. There is in consensus an agreement that something must happen. Something must come out of this exercise. Now, what are the good points about that kind of a style? What might be some good points about that? Any thoughts?
It sounds like it would be very, if people were honest, it would be very educational. And for everyone involved, in the sense that if there was industry in your town, the townspeople were there, they would have some understanding of what the difficulties are with the industry and reaching particular standards that they wanted to adopt. That the people who were very ecologically minded wanted to adopt, and how it would impact them.
Okay.
In many different ways.
Kind of a sharing of information, a sharing of an industry person can tell an environmentalist, let's say, this is what the effect is of your proposal on me. I can't do that. I can't achieve that goal. So listen to what I can achieve. And here's the impact. If you pass that, here's the impact on me in terms of jobs that are going to be available. I'm going to have to lay off 50 people because I can't do that. Or I'm going to have to close the plant because I can't make a profit, or something of that nature. So those views supposedly are all on the table in a consensus process.
Shouldn't you also add labor to the labor force there?
You bet. You bet. That's exactly right. I mean, everybody who has a stake needs to be around that table. Now, what's the bad point about consensus? Are there any bad points about consensus?
I think there's a lot of bad points about consensus. I mean, I don't think that an issue is going to get settled very easily if each person wants to get what they're after. I think the only, consensus implies, a give and take relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, if you intend to leave that table with a settled issue, it's going to be very hard to do.
Sure
in
is.
A reasonable amount of time.
That's right. It is hard to do. But let's say you make the commitment that you're going to do it. What is the spirit around that table? It's got to be a spirit of compromise, doesn't it? You've got to be willing to give. There's got to be a give and take. You may have a bottom line,
but beyond which you cannot go. But you've got to be willing to a certain point to give and take up to that bottom line anyway, to try to reach a resolution.
But in my experience, what you have are people who will fight tooth and nail to get what they want and never give in. And so compromise is very difficult. Tempers flare, I'm a design engineer, and I know from experience that if you try to design by consensus, everybody gets what they want. Nobody gets what they want.
Right.
It's just human nature.
That's interesting, because there is a certain minimum that you have to have if you're designing. I don't know what kind of a design engineer you are, but if it's a building, let's say, you can't compromise on your standards of construction. You know, you can only go so far in compromising on that. But where you might compromise is if you have a rule which requires an electrical outlet every 8 feet, as some rules do say, you may be able to compromise and say, well, you can have an electrical outlet every 12 feet. Something like that. There can be some compromise in some of these issues, but there is a certain minimum below which you can't go. You can't build a building without footings and things of that nature. So I mean, there's a certain reality. So you're right. There are bottom lines, but the assumption and consensus is that people come with their bottom line plus. They want to get all they can get. Let's take mining, for example. Many of the environmentalists that I meet in the course of my work don't want any mines. I don't want any mines. I don't care what you tell me about that mine. I don't want it. I don't want that mine. Well, when you get them around a table in consensus, you're going to say, look, mining is a practice which is recognized by most everybody has to be a legitimate exercise of our use of God's resources. They don't use God, of course, in these discussions. I mean, God is the last thing that a legislature sometimes thinks about. But mining is okay. Mining is no more illegal than an automobile plant. You know, so you can't just say you don't want any mines. What is it you're really? What are you really saying? Well, then the environmental groups will say, "Well, what we really mean by this is that we don't want the environment affected by the mind." Well, okay. Now, what does that mean? What do you mean by affected by the mind? And you begin by the exchange of ideas to try to force people to finally state what is their bottom line, and forget all the verbiage up above here about no mind. And you get down to, yeah, but how much pollution of groundwater will you put up with? Well, that's tough. It's tough to get them there, but the club that one uses on that is that if you're not there presenting your views, you're going to get something shoved down your throat through legislation. And you're not going to be happy with it, but you're going to have no power to stop it. Power is another word which comes to mind in consensus. There is an assumption that we have all these people around the table, all these stakeholders, they have equal access. That's given, they're all there in this ideal sense. But do they all have equal power? That's another issue. Different power.
It brings up a question, I think. That's a situation where you can imagine the missing link, for example, in the groundwater situation would be somebody who has knowledge that if you have certain pollutants that they're deadly, and so you can't have those certain pollutants. And so there's a bottom line that pretty much destroys everything else, in the sense that if you can't attain that, if the industry can't attain that, then in fact you're affecting the health of the townspeople, and they may not want to accept that because they lose their job. On the other hand, you know, you're in a real predicament then, I think.
That's right. There are bottom lines, and there are bottom lines. And we had a forum discussion last week. We were talking about using God's creation, man's activity in God's creation, and the comment was made in the back of the room, that, well, what about the well, what's the effect with all
greenhouse.
The greenhouse effect? I mean, it just the point was made that all this stuff is just superfluous if you don't deal with something about the greenhouse effect, because it's going to essentially end the world as we know it. Well, you can really chill a conversation about issues by bringing up something like that. And you're right. If you're saying, but what about putting this much arsenic in there? You can't avoid putting this amount of arsenic in groundwater. And therefore, if you're going to allow this practice, you're going to put in this amount of arsenic, and it's going to be a killer. Well, then, if that's the bottom line, then there is no more discussion beyond that point. Then the discussion is the elimination of that particular practice. We never resolved the greenhouse issue, but it was.
Wasn't the problem actually having? I mean, one of the difficulties I think then in the consensus is that you could imagine that there's that missing link, that there is that person missing in some of these situations.
Ah, okay, and that's. One of the problems in consensus is, what if everybody's not around that table who needs to be there? Consensus is a consensus among the participants. And that's all it is. I don't care whatever label people want to put on consensus as a style of policy development. Say, oh, this is consensus. I don't care what they say, it's a consensus, not if this issue in general. It's a consensus of the people who are around that table. That's it. And you can have missing participants. I'll give you an example. When they developed some of the mining policy in the state of Wisconsin, representatives from the only existing metal mines were not there. Now why? It's personality kinds of things. And that's another little aside which I'd love to talk to people about, and that is the effect of personality on policy development. It is has an incredible impact on policy development. There's a personality of some of these people who are involved in it. It goes beyond speaking about sometimes. But they were, because of their personality, they were not at the table. And so there were things adopted in the consensus process with which they could not possibly deal with. But then what happens? So you object to that. You object to that product. But don't you see what the answer is? Well, you weren't there. You weren't a part of the process. Where were you? What right did you have to complain about it? And this is one of the problems with consensus, is at least in my experience, the process becomes the product. If something comes out of consensus into our legislature, it has a lot of steam behind it. Our legislature, which will bicker from until, as you know, the old picture of bickering over the budget as you go past midnight, you know, you keep turning back the clock so you don't break the law kind of thing as you pass that budget. That's the way our legislature deals with these things. They go on and on and on and on. But you put a piece of consensus legislation in front of them, and they'll pass it 99-0. Why? Because they assume that around that table were all the relevant interests, and they don't want to think about groundwater. Come on, you know, they don't want to think about groundwater. That's beyond their particular interest or their expertise, for many of them, that is to say. And they probably had representatives of the legislature there around that table, and they'll defer to that. But in many cases, the process becomes a product. And I think you can get some pretty shoddy policy passed in the name of consensus. I think that's a problem with consensus, in my experience. Now, these are the three styles. They may not be the only ones, but these are three styles which, in my experience, that I've seen dealing with technical issues. And I have a fourth one which I don't have much direct experience with except as an observer of it. And I'll present that to to you and see what you think of it, and we can kind of decide whether it makes any sense or not.
Are there any Canadians here? Anybody from Canada?
Oh, good. Then I can say wherever I want. I won't get back to them.
What?
They don't get back to them.
Yeah. Actually, I have good feelings about this. It may sound from my comments that I don't have good feelings about any of this stuff, but I do. I do have good feelings. But I just understand that in any of these styles of dealing with technical issues, there are strengths and weaknesses. And we just need to be aware of them as a public. When you read in your paper that the legislature has passed a piece of groundwater legislation, think about what went into that passage of that legislation, what compromises might have been built into that. Who was present around some consensus effort? Anyway, the fourth style I'd like to talk about is what I call, I think they're called Board of Inquiries. And they have a big name like Royal Commissions and Boards of Inquiry or something of that nature. And they're usually established by provincial governments in Canada to deal with a particularly tough issue. There has been one in, I think, both Ontario and Saskatchewan, both on uranium issues. And there's a third one also on uranium issue, and that's the one I'm most familiar with, and that was the Board of Inquiry done in British Columbia on uranium mining. And what a Board of Inquiry attempts to do, the provincial government appoints commissioners, in this case there were three, and they say, we want you to tell us what should be the provincial policy with respect to uranium mining. This is such a big issue, and there seem to be such feelings built around this issue that we can't, as provincial legislators, deal with this issue very effectively. And therefore, they appoint this Royal Commission, this Board of Inquiry. And the Board of Inquiry is these three people, but they have a staff. They give them resources. They have a staff that goes out and researches the topics. And then they also have participants, and I'm not sure exactly what the formal name for them is, but the participants are to be all the stakeholders in a particular issue. And anybody who's interested in the issue can be a participant, because money is no object. Obviously, a uranium company will have plenty of money to participate, and they'll want to participate, because if this commission is going to develop policy for the province on uranium mining, they want to be there, because they obviously have a clear stake in it, and they'll be there with their own money and their own lawyers. But what about an environmental group in a small town near a uranium deposit? Well, they may not have the resources to deal with it. So built into this concept is that the Board of Inquiry will listen to a request for support, financial support. And if there is an obvious connection to the problem, in other words, I couldn't go up there as a U.S. citizen saying, gee, I'm just interested in the issue, will you fund me to participate? You know, I would not have a stake in really the answer to the question. So, but if that commission determines that yes, you are a stakeholder, you do have a perspective, even though you may be only 10 people, we will fund you. We will provide money for you so you can go out and get your own attorney, if that's what you want to do, or your own consultants and participate in this. We just have to pre-approve your expenditures and this kind of thing. So there is a certain control on that, I suppose. But basically, the idea is that nobody who's a true stakeholder in the issue is eliminated simply because they don't have money. They can all participate. And then what happens is that you gather information, and you do it in phases. And I think there were 9 phases in the uranium mining thing in British Columbia. And it'll go from birth to death. It'll go from where is the resource and how was it formed to nuclear weapons and nuclear power systems. I mean, it goes the whole gamut of topics. All of these can be relevant to this inquiry, because the assumption is that this issue is so broad-based that it reaches out into all aspects of the thing. So you're allowed to look at all of this stuff. The Royal Commission decides on what are called articles of reference, which determines the scope of their investigation. And this one in British Columbia was very, very broad-based. And so they began to gather information on this. And what happens is that you gather testimony. But the testimony is not some person sitting up there in front of somebody else saying, uranium mining is bad for your health. You know, I just know that it's bad for your health. Because that person, while they make that statement, is subject to cross-examination by every one of the participants in the process. You know, and you know the companies are going to have legal representation. That's why everybody else maybe needs either legal representation or technical representation around that table. And the idea is that everybody is subject to cross-examination. Nobody is able to get up there and just say what they think and get away with it. You're up there to say what you think, but that you have to justify. You are subject to cross-examination. And the commissioners can ask questions. The staff can ask. The staff kind of acts as sort of a neutral questioner in the whole process. And then everybody else, of course, has an axe to grind, and they can ask their questions and stuff. And what you do, you're making a huge record, a huge body of information from which the commissioners then will make decisions about that particular policy issue. Okay, what's good about that? Fairly obvious.
Is this just in Canada? This doesn't take place in the United States, right?
Nothing of this nature, to my knowledge, takes place in the U.S.
Because I worked on environmental issues with the island where I live, and what often happens is just what you sort of said there, that the people with a financial stake in it have attorneys, have
sure.
money behind it, because they have they stand to make a great profit if this thing goes through. Whereas environmental people usually are just volunteers. They don't have the time or the money to search out the expert information.
How do you deal then with the moneyed interests?
Not very well. They usually win. Okay. I think this would be a
correct. So this is an attempt to get at that.
Yeah,
that's a very real problem. And boy, we see it in the U.S. all the time. Unequal resources available. It's not always money, it's also information. But there's nothing more powerful than somebody who's got the information, you know, and they can really lay it on.
You don't always know what is going to happen in the future, do you? I mean, even though you think you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Just like what's happened when they put off some of those tailings back in the mine. They like the water.
That's right. You have no... By
assurance.
By being a technical person, you have no guarantee that you understand the future. I'll grant you that. There's no question about that. But with a board of inquiry, how about other benefits from that? Financial equality, financial access is there. So access to the process is available to everybody. But doesn't resolve the problem of power.
Yeah, how are the commissioners chosen? That's because it sounds like they have tremendous power in the end.
Fundamental problem with this process is who chooses and who is chosen to be the commissioners. But get away from it. How do you get away from it? Somebody's got to make the choice. Somebody's got to make decisions. And that's, you can't ever get away from that with the board of inquiry. I was just amazed at the depth of information that had been gathered, and the breadth of information on all sides that was gathered by this inquiry into uranium mining in British Columbia. But ultimately it came down to the three commissioners. And when I would talk with the staff director about the commissioners, it's very clear that each of those three commissioners had personalities, viewpoints, ideas.
But you could control their decision-making process legally, I think. You could make them accountable, which I think would have a tremendous impact on what they finally decided. You could make them accountable by actually making them quantify their policy from the base of knowledge that they get.
The record is there.
Yeah.
Does your decision follow the record? And my gosh, we know that in lawsuits related to a decision by an administrative process, that's always subject to the record. You know, do these findings of fact follow from the record? And those are always grounds to contest a decision in an administrative law process. I guess we'll have to close, but I just want to say that there may not be any hard and fast answers here, but I think there's something that the Board of Inquiry, something that it tells us. I can't argue too much with the kids because one of mine. there's something about this which I think is important, and that is the issue of access. And I think that's an important positive thing about the Board of Inquiry. But always our technical decisions are being made in a non-technical world. And how we go about making those decisions, I think, affects the quality of those decisions. And that's what I wanted to share with you this morning. And I appreciate
it. I have one question. In our area, the meat packers have been fined. They've made millions of dollars for polluting. What happens to all that money? First, they go into law, and then they get excused.
Get it reduced. that's a good question, and it kind of depends. My experience has been, Vern, you may have a perspective on this.
Typically, into the general fund.
You can just go right back into general purpose revenues, and our Department of Natural Resources, which deals with environmental regulations on a broad scale, as well as wildlife management and everything else, kind of complains about that, because you think it's going to go back to help you do the enforcement work that brought about the recognition of this was a violation and therefore they needed to be fined. Well, it never works quite that way. It always
clean up pollution or something.
Generally it goes back to general purpose revenues and then can hit, but the connection is never as direct as you might like to see it. It usually goes back to GPR. And the agency makes requests through the budget process for monies to handle cleanup. And of course, there are always exceptions. There are special cleanup funds.
Oh, sure. And then the governor has to have some road pushes lined around the capital.
Yeah.
Spent $100,000 for $5,000 worth of roses.
But do you ever wonder why those places are always the most beautiful places in the city, or why banks are always the most beautiful buildings in the city? I mean, you ever wonder what do they do with all your money, right? Okay. We can continue the discussion informally, and if you wish, I'd be very interested to talk about this. This is something that I struggle with really a lot, is how we make these kinds of decisions. And I think there have been some pretty shoddy decisions made, but then again, this is the process we deal with.